Joe Boyd is a record producer who happens to have been involved with some of the stellar artists of our time. For instance, he was the stage manager the day that Dylan went electric at Newport. We'll certainly get his perspective on that, as well as his work as a record producer for Fairport Convention and for Nick Drake on his legendary albums. Joe Boyd has written of all this in his memoir, White Bicycles. In that book, he says that for him, the 60s started in 1956 when Dick Clark became the host of American Bandstand, which was then a local record hop show near where Joe grew up in New Jersey. I ask him why that date in 1956.
For me, the momentous thing that happened with that show was that Bob Horn, who was the original host, who was one of those guys like Alan Freed, one of those sort of middle-aged hipsters who kind of acted as a bridge between black rhythm and blues and white teenagers, he got fired in 1956 and replaced by Dick Clark. And it seemed at the time to change the show. And in retrospect, I've just done some research and found out about some of the things that happened. And it seems as if that change was part of a general surge by the big companies and the big organizations to kind of get all this riffraff out of the middle of the top 40 charts and, you know, make the top 40 a bit whiter and a bit more corporate. And as soon as that happened, people like me started looking to blues and folk music and jazz, and it was that veering away from pop music, which then rebounded back in the middle 60s and captured pop music again. And I think that's where that whole movement began.
It's also kind of funny. I don't want to dwell too much on the introduction to the book, but it's also funny that you end the 60s before I would end the 60s. I always tell people that the 60s happened in the 70s. But for you, it ended in London in, what, 67?
No. I said it peaked in London in 67.
Yeah.
It started a long, slow decline. And my date that I have for the end is the autumn of 73 with the Persian Gulf crisis, because for me, one of the key things about the 60s was people had so much time. The economy was so loose. You know, you could work part-time and pay for an apartment in Greenwich Village or Laurel Canyon or Berkeley or Harvard Square and spend half your time playing the guitar and writing songs. And I think once the economy started tightening up and everything, all the essentials started costing a lot more money, you had to work longer at a normal job to live, then that sort of freedom that the 60s represented kind of evaporated.
In the beginning of what we'll call your career, did you find jobs just to be able to hang around the music?
No. I was, from the time I was 17, I read a book by Sam Charters called The Country Blues, and there were wonderful stories about different blues singers, but the character that jumped out of the pages at me was Ralph Peer, who was a producer for Bluebird Records, who went around the South and recorded jug bands and country music artists and blues artists. And I said, boy, what a cool thing to do, you know. And it took me a while to get my head around the idea that you could still do it, mm-hmm. that this job was still there to be done in the music of my day. And once I had that revelation, I was, you know, absolutely pointed like an arrow at being a record producer. So everything I did was aimed at that.
One of the eye-opening high points for me was that tour you took to Europe with the Blues Caravan. And it seems that you worked some kind of magic was worked among the performers who were very resistant to working together at first.
Well, I was very naive. You know, I assumed because they were, you know, black blues and gospel singers, they must know each other. And, of course, it turned out they didn't. And they each had their own agenda, their own set that they were used to doing, that they were having to pare down to a minimum because it was a crowded package. And they resented any idea that, you know, they should play with somebody else or they should change their set or something like that. But over the course of the, you know, they rejected all of my original suggestions. But over the course of the next 2 weeks, they started listening to each other, and they were fascinated. And particularly the most touching thing was Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was very sophisticated, you know, been to France many times and had a very expensive wig and a very expensive fur coat. And Gary Davis, who was another, I mean, rural gospel singer, which is what Sister Rosetta began as, but he'd never really left. You know, he was still a kind of battered, close to the ground sort of character, you know. And she was horrified by him at first. You know, she thought it was very bringing down the tone of the tour to have such a country, you know, backward kind of guy. And by the end of the tour, she adored him, and she thought he was the deepest man I've ever met. And they sang together the last night in Brighton in one of the most hair-raising, fantastic moments of music I think I ever heard.
What did they do?
Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, and let me stand. I'm tired, somebody is so tired, and I'm weak, Lord, you work so hard through life, this whole body of mine is worn, oh yes, but you got to go anyhow in the rain or the storm, through the storm, through in front of me, Jesus, lead me on to the light. I can't make it unless you go with me. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on.
We're talking to Joe Boyd about his book, White Bicycles, and his experiences in music from the 1960s up until now. The Incredible String Band was probably your first chance to really work with the band, and they were such an amazing conglomeration of talents. As they got older, more disparate, I would say. And talk about the early Incredible String Band and what it was like to work with them.
Well, I first saw Robin and Clive in a pub in Edinburgh. And they weren't doing their original compositions at all. They were taking Scott's ballads and pretending that they'd gone to the Appalachians with a kind of side trip through the Balkans and maybe Morocco or something. And I just thought they were original, wonderful, talented pair. And then when I came back, I was working for Elektra Records, and they'd added Mike Heron. And Robin and Mike had started writing songs. And the songs were just extraordinary, I thought, really great songs. And there was a little bit of rivalry there. If Robin wrote a good song, Mike would say, okay, well, I'm going to put on all the harmonies, I'm going to put on the extra instruments, and he would try and come up with something in terms of an arrangement which was as creative as Robin had been in writing the song in the first place, and vice versa.
Now, what do you as a producer learn about trying to manage that kind of situation? Do you stand back from it, or do you try to manage it?
Well, you stand back. You manage it by standing back.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you get heavy-handed, it usually doesn't work. It was the lesson I learned, in a way, with the Blues Caravan, you know, that I tried to do something the first day, and everybody balked and said, get out of here. And if I stood back, it would sort of happen naturally, and I could guide it and encourage it in subtle ways. And that's a lesson that was very valuable for me in the studio.
Now, as someone working for Elektra Records, Incredible String Band, my recollection, probably didn't sell a whole lot of records there in the early days.
The String Band, from the beginning, did well. The very first album, you know, right off the bat, sold about 5,000 in the UK, which was quite startling, you know, at a time when you could have a successful folk record that sold 1,000 or 2,000. And the second record, 5,000 Spirits for the Layers of the Onion, was a huge success.
And then there were other amazing things like the I was thinking of the U album, which was just this amazing kind of collaborative thing production.
Well, U is unfortunately I you know, that was the kind of end of the line as far as I was concerned with the Incredible String Band. I was a bit disturbed they'd become Scientologists, and they lived in this sort of row of cottages out in the country in Scotland, and they invited all these dancers and costumers and mimes and people to come and live with them in this group of cottages, and they created this pageant called You. And I thought the songs were not as good as their normal output, and this thing was going to be hugely expensive to tour. And I just said, look, you guys are out of your mind. You shouldn't do this. And they insisted. And, of course, it was a kind of financial disaster. And that was a point where I felt they're not listening to me. They're not taking my advice. And so I accepted a job in California.
Well, let's go back and listen to some of these something from the early days of the Incredible String Band. This is just a personal pick. It's this is this moment from Incredible String Band.
This moment is different from any before it. This moment is different. It's now. And if I don't kiss you, that kiss is untasted. I'll never, no, never get it back. But why should I want to? I'll be in the next moment, sweet moment, sweet lover, sweet now.
This moment from the Incredible String Band, the one of the first major productions of Joe Boyd, who is our guest today. And Joe has written a book about his life producing and working with music called White Bicycles, which is just a fascinating look at the history of a whole bunch of music, both in England and here in the States. The cover photo of White Bicycles takes place at one of the Newport Folk Festivals. I want to talk a little bit about Newport with you because it's funny. We've interviewed numerous people about the plug pulling, the wire cutting, the whatever happened when Dylan went electric. We've talked to Al Cooper about it. We've talked to George Ween about it. I believe we even talked to Pete a bit about it. What we're talking about is the idea that when Dylan went electric, that Pete Seeger wanted to chop the cord, the electric cord that went on stage. Which turns out in nobody's version did that happen, or did that even come close to happen? What was your view of that scene?
Well, this is one situation where I think I can say that I had the best view of anybody, because I was the production manager. It was my responsibility to get Dylan on stage, to get the sound checked, to get the, you know, I'd asked my friend Paul Rothschild, the great producer, to come up and mix the sound. And he had rehearsed the sound late that afternoon on stage. And everything, you know, we had notes about all the other performers on pieces of paper, on a clipboard. But with Dylan, I'd bought this fluorescent pink marker. And every setting on the board and every setting of the amps and the mic positions on stage and the settings on the amps was marked with this glow-in-the-dark pink so that we could get there in the dark and have everything set from the first note. And, of course, from the first note, it was very loud by the standards of that time, and people were very shocked by it. And I was enjoying it. I was just standing in the press enclosure enjoying it, and somebody came and said to me, they need you backstage, you know, and I went backstage, and there was Seeger and Alan Lomax and Theodore Bickel, and they were livid.
They were on the board of Newport.
Yeah, they were on the governing board of the festival, and they were beside themselves and demanded to know how to get the sound turned down. And I said, well, there's no walkie-talkie. You'll have to go out to the sound controls and, you know, walk out to the parking lot and walk up there and walk to the front entrance and down the main aisle, and you'll find it in row G. And they could see that that would take them far too long, and so they demanded that I jump the fence and go and tell them to turn the sound down. And of course, when I went out there, Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul and Mary, who was also on the board, was sitting there with Albert Grossman and Paul Rothschild, and they just said, the sound's fine. And Peter Yarrow actually extended his middle finger as part of the message that I should take back to Lomax. And when I got back, Seeger was walking out to the parking lot. He couldn't stand to listen anymore. You know, it's not practical. You couldn't chop any one wire and get the whole sound cut off. I mean, it was ridiculous. But I think Seeger was quoted once as saying that he was so upset that if he'd had an axe, he would have cut the, you know, I think that's where the thing may have come from.
Well, we've resolved that myth, indeed. What did he open with?
Maggie's Farm. And he did Maggie's Farm, Takes a Lot to Laugh, Takes a Train to Cry, and Like a Rolling Stone. And then there was a long gap because he went off stage, he didn't want to come back. But he'd only done three songs, and he had 45 minutes. And finally he comes back on and does Mr. Tambourine Man, and It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which I took as a kind of sign to the old guard. You know, it was a very, very historic moment, but not just the fact of going electric, but in a way it was Dylan's farewell to the didactic, politically oriented songwriting that he had become famous for, and that, in a way, the left wing, which is where the folk music movement had been born, in a way, was in the bosom of the political left, were devastated because their Pied Piper was leaving them.
That's the story of Bob Dylan at Newport, and that's Like a Rolling Stone on the World Cafe today. David Dye, we are talking with Joe Boyd about White Bicycles making music in the 1960s and some of the work he did. Probably at this point, I was surprised to learn, actually, that the Incredible String Band sold as well as they did. But I'm pretty sure that probably the production that most people want to talk with you about, which is your work with Nick Drake, didn't sell so well at the time. Is that accurate?
Yeah. No, it didn't. It didn't sell at all. It was devastating. I mean, in retrospect, you can see why. I had this, when I first heard his songs, I thought not that he was similar artistically, but just in terms of a category of how you would promote him, I thought of Leonard Cohen's first record and the fact that it had sold very well when Cohen was saying, I'm a poet, I'm not a singer, and he refused to perform in public. And I knew that Nick would have terrible difficulties performing in public because he was so bashful and so shy and he had no chat for an audience at all. And so I just thought, well, we'll make a great record. And like Leonard Cohen's record, the power of the record will just force its way into the market. And it didn't happen. And partly because in England, you didn't have the freeform FM stations the way you did here. And there was nobody besides John Peel who was really going to play it. And it was terribly sad because Nick was kind of broken by it, you know, I think, by the failure of his music to get across.
And you tried various, as you went on moving with him, you tried various different ways of putting the music across as well.
Well, yeah, I think it's funny. I don't remember thinking about it this way, but in listening back, you know, 10 years ago when we were putting together one of the compilations or something, I listened back to all the records. And Five Leaves Left, the first record, has strings and a lot of other instruments, but no drums. Brighter Later, almost every track has drums.
Right.
And then Pink Moon has nothing except, you know. But that was, in a way, Nick's own response to Brighter Later, which I think I got the feeling Nick was so hesitant to say things. But I realized when we finished the record and he listened to the record and he came to me and he said, the next record is going to be just me and guitar. And I took it as a kind of rebuke that he felt we'd sort of run away with his music a bit, that there's too much stuff on, too many other personalities had kind of interfered. And I'm not sure how much he liked Brighter Later.
I never felt magic crazy as this. I never saw moons, knew the meaning of the sea. I never held emotion in the palm of my hand. Felt sweet breezes in the top of a tree, but now you're here. Brighten my northern sky. I've been a long time that I'm waiting. I've been a long time that I'm blown. Been a long time that I've wandered, but through the people I have known. Oh, if you would and you could straighten my new mind's eye.
Northern Sky from Brighter Later, from Nick Drake, as we're talking to Joe Boyd about some of the work he's done over the years, and just some of the amazing productions that came out on the Witch Season label, on Island Records, and many other things. And of course, after that, Hannibal, which was kind of a labor of love. That's actually not covered very much in the book or at all, really.
Well, Hannibal began in 1980.
Yeah,
and calling it a labor of love is. Well, I don't know.
you wouldn't even go there at all.
Love, hate.
Yeah,
you know, it was. Very, very hard work. I mean, it was, I threw myself into it from 1980 onwards and kept it going as an independent label for 10 years and before sort of selling it and myself to Rykodisc. And those 10 years, I mean, I did some very, you know, some things I'm really happy to look back on, records that I love and projects and adventures that I had that were fantastic. But at the time, it was the most stressful time of my life because I had a payroll to meet every Friday. I had royalty statements to to meet every 6 months. And it was rough because I was underfinanced and the record business is a tough business.
It's kind of an odd question, but I'm curious. Did you make any money at this?
I have ended up getting a steady trickle of royalties from the records and things like Nick Drake and, you know, have surged over the years, and it's nice, but it's not. It certainly hasn't made me rich.
White Bicycles, making music in the 1960s, is Joe Boyd's new look back at the music he made during the 1960s and before, and it's on Serpent's Tail Press. We'll be back in a moment here on the World Cafe.